Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How might America's 27 million diabetics manage their disease in the future, and how would staying in better control change their lifelong health? According to the Juvenile Diabetes Research Foundation, 1 in 10 adults in the U.S. has diabetes today. That number is expected to climb to 1 in 3 by the middle of this century. Untreated diabetes can be fatal, and poorly managed diabetes carries with it a huge host of debilitating complications, including infection, blindness, heart disease, kidney disease, and stroke. But while the growing number of cases is sobering, there is also growing optimism that tools for managing diabetes might soon extend far beyond the traditional methods of monitoring blood sugar and trying to calculate an effective dose of medicine to help the body process it. My two guests are here today to talk about the progress that has been made. Dr. Gregory Clark is an endocrinologist specializing in diabetes. He conducts research at UT Southwestern Medical Center, where he also serves as assistant professor. Jeffrey Brewer is president and CEO of the Juvenile Diabetes Research Foundation, which holds its annual fundraising gala this Saturday, March 26th. Gentlemen, welcome to Think.
Thank you for having us.
It's great to be here.
Greg, can you start talking about how a non-diabetic's body processes the food energy that we take in without really having to think about it at all?
Sure. Yes, it's a system that is very exquisitely regulated, mostly by insulin that's secreted by the pancreas. So when someone eats a meal, that food is broken down and glucose or sugar enters into the bloodstream, as do proteins, amino acids, and fats. And insulin, which is released from the pancreas, is released in a minute-by-minute fashion. And so as blood glucose levels even begin to slightly increase, insulin secretion also increases. And that keeps blood glucose levels constant. The insulin that is secreted by the pancreas only works for a matter of a couple of minutes. And so with that, the system is very finely regulated.
And in a diabetic, too much sugar can be released into the bloodstream after we eat. Talk about what makes that so harmful.
So high blood glucose levels do a number of things. They cause tissue damage. They adhere. Blood glucose concentrations, when they're elevated, leads to the attaching of glucose to molecules, to structures in the body that ultimately leads to their dysfunction, mostly blood vessel problems. It ultimately can lead to blindness, kidney disease, nerve disease, heart attack, and stroke.
So I think it's important also to point out that there are two very different kinds of diabetes.
That's my next question.
Okay. They both involve a dysregulation of glucose, elevated glucose levels, which can lead to the complications that you referred to a minute ago. But they both develop these two types in different ways. Type 1 diabetes, which was formerly known as juvenile diabetes, is the kind of diabetes that our organization is concerned with, although there is some overlap in terms of the complications. Type 1 diabetes is an autoimmune disease. It is a disease whereby the body's immune system decides, for reasons that we still don't fully understand, to attack and destroy the cells that produce insulin. And insulin being required to regulate glucose in the bloodstream, being required for metabolism and for life, once those cells are gone, a person becomes dependent on insulin from outside the body.
So a type 1 diabetic doesn't have the option to simply control exercise and diet. A type 1 diabetic is dependent upon insulin. That's artificial.
Yes, that's correct. A type 1 diabetic does not make any insulin over time, such that that person needs to finally calibrate the food they eat, the exercise they do, with the insulin that must come from outside, usually through injections, sometimes given through an insulin pump that gives a continuous delivery and then allows extra insulin to be administered at mealtime.
What's the difference between the artificial insulin that type 1 diabetics and some type 2 diabetics take and the stuff that our bodies produce naturally when they're working properly?
Well, very little. Insulins are so good today that they're very close to the human insulin. Used to be that we obtained in the early days insulin from pigs and from cows. However, today we have engineered versions of insulin which are very close to human insulin. However, it's important to note that the way insulin works depends on how it is administered. When a pancreas and the cells in the pancreas produce insulin, that insulin goes right into the bloodstream and has an almost immediate effect in terms of managing blood glucose. And as Greg said, works within minutes. The insulin that most type 1 diabetics take and the insulin that type 2 diabetics take is administered through the subcutaneous tissue, through the fatty tissue in the body, and takes a much longer time to work, which makes introduces an additional challenge in terms of people managing their blood sugar. It takes insulin 15 to 45 minutes, depending on the person, to start working. It works over the course of hours. So in terms of actually matching the carbohydrates a person consumes to the insulin a person needs to take, it becomes a rather challenging problem that they have to face all day, every day.
So there's this constant calibration of energy in and insulin to manage that energy, and the longer time it takes to sort of get that match right, the more time that people have levels of blood sugar that are either too high or too low. Is that correct?
Yes, that's exactly right. In fact, I would say that for someone living with type 1 diabetes, every meal is a roller coaster ride where the blood glucose goes up initially as a result of the food consumed, and then when the insulin kicks in, the blood glucose level comes back down, hopefully to a normal range before eating the next meal. But that requires a very exquisite balancing act between not only the food and the insulin, but also exercise and stress.
So let's talk about some of the new therapies that are out there in development. Jeffrey, your organization is really invested in and interested in this thing called an artificial pancreas. Talk about how that works.
Sure. Well, JDRF was founded just about 40 years ago in order to cure this disease and remove it from people's lives entirely. That's a goal to which we remain committed. However, in order to do that, it's a marathon, not a sprint. And on the way, we think that there are some really big opportunities to change fundamentally how people live with this disease, to help them live better and healthier and well until we do have that cure. And one of the nearest term opportunities to do that is an artificial pancreas, which is very simply an insulin pump, which I mentioned before, which is a common method of administration of insulin for type 1 diabetics, an insulin pump that is talking to what's called a continuous glucose monitor, a device that measures glucose levels in the body over time on a minute-by-minute basis. And in between those two sits a computer algorithm that, based on the level of glucose in the body, based on the insulin that's been previously administered, based on the carbohydrates a person consumes, makes decisions and doses insulin in order to try and keep a person at a more normal blood sugar level, in order to try and tame that roller coaster that Greg mentioned a minute ago, to do it all the time, including when a person's sleeping, which is one of the most dangerous times for a type 1 diabetic, because you give yourself insulin and maybe you gave too much, and you could experience dangerous hypoglycemia, which can result in not only a sick feeling, but unconsciousness. And if no one's around to help and provide glucose, such as orange juice, a person could die. And unfortunately, that happens.
And I guess one of the advantages to doing this all automatically is that even if particular individuals are pre-compliant because they're kids, or they're not compliant because they just can't quite get with the rhythm of the treatment program, the machines sort of help take over some of that function?
That is absolutely the case. Very meaningful. It's going to be very impactful for people who are not very compliant, as you say, with the doctor's orders. But it's hard to be compliant, you know, when you can't be thinking about diabetes, yeah, such as when you're asleep or if you are a child and not capable of doing that for yourself. There is, even with compliance, we think an opportunity to do it better than people are doing it today. It's a very hard thing to do. It requires a tremendous amount of a person's daily bandwidth, so to speak. You have to think about type 1 diabetes when you get up in the morning, when you go to sleep, every time you eat, every time you exercise, if you're sick, if you're stressed, because all these things affect blood sugar and how insulin works in the body. There are so many decisions to be made in terms of what insulin to give at what time in response to what carbohydrates. You have to look at a piece of bread and understand how many carbohydrates that represents. Mm-hmm. You take a guess, and sometimes you're right, sometimes you're wrong. You need to correct, test your blood sugar later after that meal has been absorbed. There's so much thinking and decision-making that needs to take place in order to live well with this disease. And so we think that in addition to taking the burden off of people in terms of being responsible for their health on a 24/7 basis, this is also going to improve quality of life. And that's a very important part of what we're doing.
Now, it's not commercially available yet. Is that right? Still testing?
It's still testing. It has been tested in an inpatient setting, meaning in a hospital where if it didn't work, you'd be safe. Mm-hmm. These trials now that will predict when a person is experiencing low blood sugar and cut off insulin delivery, which happens on a 24/7 basis with an insulin pump, are currently moving to an outpatient basis, meaning people will go home and have these tools sleeping to try and protect them from overnight hypoglycemic episodes. We'll be taking steps towards a real-world environment where we test these things, make sure they're absolutely safe before they're generally available to the public. But we think the technology is there today. It will support a level of automation that will protect people from dangerous events that occur with living with this disease.
So we'll talk a little bit more about this technology in a minute. Greg, I want to talk about what's taking place at UT Southwestern. One of the things that is under research is potentially other hormones that might play a role in controlling diabetes other than insulin.
Yes, that's right. So we're all very excited about a recent clinical trial that has begun to test leptin, an analog of leptin. Leptin is a natural hormone made by the body, made by the fat cells. This analog is called metreleptin. And leptin itself is a hormone that we know is critically important to the regulation of blood glucose and also blood fats and cholesterol. And we know a lot about leptin in animal models of type 1 diabetes, all thanks mostly to Roger Unger. All of what I'm about to tell you about animal models of type 1 diabetes should be credited really to the creative genius of Roger Unger. For example, we know that diabetic animals with no insulin whatsoever can survive just by treating them with leptin alone, which in itself is remarkable. Not since the discovery and commercialization of insulin in 1921 by Banting and Best and Eli Lilly have we believed that there was a hormone that could protect an animal from certain death. But leptin has seemed to do this in rodents. Mind you, none of us believes that ultimately we will be treating type 1 diabetes with leptin alone and no insulin. We believe insulin is also critically important. But the most remarkable thing is that when we treat animals, rodents, mice, with leptin in a reduced dose of insulin, their diabetes is much easier to treat. You smooth out this roller coaster ride of blood glucose increases and plummets, really. And so in the short term, what we hope is that by adding leptin to one's insulin regimen and by reducing their dose of insulin, we will reduce the daily burden of managing the disease. Jeffrey, highlighted the fact really that the biological manifestations of this disease are profound, but equally profound are the psychological and social manifestations because of everything that is required to manage it. I have patients who prick their finger with a needle 10 times per day in order to get a drop of blood to test their blood glucose concentration. They administer insulin 4 to 6 times per day, or they infuse it continuously via an insulin pump. And sometimes when they're working their hardest and trying to do their best, they then develop a debilitating low blood glucose reaction that makes them then want to throw their arms up in the air and just say, forget this. Mm-hmm. And so, things like an artificial pancreas, hormones like leptin that can help take the edge off, give us great hope. Now, we have just started a clinical trial to test leptin, and so it's still too early to begin talking about, whether or not ultimately it will help. But we remain full of hope.
My guests this hour are Dr. Gregory Clark, endocrinologist at UT Southwestern Medical Center, and Jeffrey Brewer, president and CEO of the Juvenile Diabetes Research Foundation. We'll resume our conversation in a moment and invite you to join us now with your questions at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for THINK comes from SMU's summer youth programs, camps in computers, writing, art, math, science, and Legos held at SMU in Plano and on the main campus in Dallas. You can learn more at smu.edu/summeryouth.
You're listening to THINK on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guests this hour are Jeffrey Brewer, President and CEO of the Juvenile Diabetes Research Foundation, which this Saturday, March 26th, will hold its annual Dream Gala at the Hilton Anatole in Dallas. Dr. Gregory Clark is here as well. He's an endocrinologist specializing in diabetes. He's also a researcher and assistant professor at UT Southwestern Medical Center. If you'd like to join the conversation today, give us a call at 1-800-933-5372. Or send email to think@kera.org. What do we know about genes that have been identified that either make people more or less susceptible to either form of diabetes?
Well, we do know that there are some genes that have been associated with type 1 diabetes that confer increased risk of contracting the disease. But there has been a marked increase in the prevalence and incidence of type 1 diabetes over the years. We believe that it might be growing in children as much as 5% per year. That data comes from Finland, where they actually have the most complete surveillance of the growth of this disease. However, with that growth, we know there's got to be an environmental influence. The gene pool doesn't change that quickly. So we have some suspects for what might be contributing to type 1 diabetes, but we don't really know yet. But we know that our modern environments have to be contributing to it in some way. There are theories that some viruses might be associated with the development of type 1 diabetes, a virus which is identified in the immune system as something that looks similar to the cells that produce insulin, and therefore the body's immune system may get confused and attack those cells. But that's still very early. We think that there might be some other environmental components that contribute to the development of the disease.
Greg, I'm curious about type 2 diabetes. We know that the rates are increasing in part because of our obesity crisis in this country. Why, though, are specific ethnic groups, and I'm thinking of African Americans and Latinos, particularly vulnerable compared with other populations?
It's not entirely clear. There may be some genetic predisposition, and as is the case with all forms of diabetes, it's both genetic predisposition as well as environment. And so I think there are certain things about the way that we all live, our access to healthcare resources, our access to eat healthy, to supermarkets in the neighborhood that provide healthy foods. But I think it's multifactorial, and that's what makes it such a difficult problem to address.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to Charles in Plano. Hi, Charles.
Hi, Chris. Great show. I think this is such a worthy topic. My nephew, 13 years old, was recently diagnosed with type 1 a few months back. And what I've really found, and his family's really found, that we really think that type 1 should be called something else other than type 1 diabetes, not for any medical reason. Maybe it should be called autoimmune disorder XYZ or something. But I say that because I think it's a real disservice to the people with type 1 to be exposed to the perception that they need to lose weight, they need to eat less, you know, they need to exercise more. That's the general perception people have when they find out you have diabetes, and that applies to type 2, not type 1, you know. I'll give you a perfect example of this. When a well-meaning acquaintance of my sister had heard that my nephew was diagnosed with diabetes, mm-hmm. and started giving her advice on this wonderful diet that would help him lose weight and have more energy and exercise more. But my nephew is extremely active. He does not have 1 ounce of fat on him, big sportsman. And my sister was telling this, you know, well-meaning acquaintance that that information applied to type 2, not to type 1 at all. You know, he's not overweight, doesn't eat too much, great diet already. And this person was saying, no, you really need to give this a try. It really does work. And it just would not hear her. And she ended up telling my sister, you know, well, you know, if you don't believe in it, if you're not going to try it, then obviously it's not going to work for you.
Well, I see, Jeffrey, I see you nodding your head. This is something that you've experienced in your own family?
Well, it is something I've experienced as a parent where telling people my child has type 1 diabetes, they do assume that it's a lifestyle driven disease, and that in fact we could have done something different, our child could do something different in order to address the disease, and that's a little frustrating, and so I can empathize with the gentleman's concern about that. We do have a challenging naming history with this disease in general. You'll note that the name of our foundation is the Juvenile Diabetes Research Foundation. That's because when this organization was founded, the disease was called juvenile diabetes, and type 2 was called adult onset diabetes. So because it was thought that the kind that kids got was juvenile, the autoimmune disease, mm-hmm. and the kind that adults got was the lifestyle-driven disease. The facts began to confuse that because we realized that there were adults that come down with type 1 diabetes. And even today, we realize that as much as 50% of people diagnosed with the disease on a yearly basis may be older than 20 years. So it's about half and half, children and adults. This is as much an adult disease as it is a child's disease.
And excuse me for interrupting, juvenile diabetes lasts a lifetime. It doesn't go away with adulthood.
Correct. That's right. So type 1 diabetes, they introduced the nomenclature type 1 and type 2 because they found that juvenile diabetics were coming down with this disease as an adult. And as you say, it does last for a lifetime or until there is a cure. And of course, as you know, has been popular in the media recently, type 2 diabetes is now being discovered in children.
Well, I want to talk about that. There is certainly, as Charles made evident, a great deal of stigma attached to people who have type 2 diabetes. It appears already that prevention efforts are not succeeding. So do we need to adjust the way we talk about the disease? We certainly want people to understand that there is a huge lifestyle component to type 2 diabetes. But are we doing something wrong in the way we're trying to communicate this, Greg?
Are we doing something wrong in the way that we communicate? I think part of the problem is that type 1 diabetes is just much less common mm-hmm. than type 2 diabetes is, especially in the adult population. And so there are probably 9 times as many people with type 2 diabetes as there is type 1 diabetes. And so to some extent, although I do agree that maybe a new name would be beneficial, I think more than anything, we just need to talk more about type 1 diabetes and what exactly it is. And how it differs from type 2 diabetes and how it's much more difficult to manage than type 2 diabetes.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Fort Worth. We'll speak with Brian. Hi, Brian.
Yes. I'm aware that doctors, endocrinologists in particular, advocate very, very tight, rigid control of blood sugars to try to get them as normal as possible to prevent the vascular disease that causes strokes, heart attacks, kidney failure, and things like that. But I had read somewhere where it may not be the level of the blood sugar itself, but something else that is causing the damage to the organs and not the blood sugar. And is that wrong? And if it's right, why do we need the rigid control of these blood sugars?
Well, let's get a response for you. Thanks for your call.
So the Diabetes Control and Complications Trial, which is the most important trial that has been done in the field of type 1 diabetes, has clearly shown that by reducing average blood glucose levels, one can minimize their risk of developing diabetes complications. And so we know that glucose control is important. We typically assess average glucose control by looking at hemoglobin A1C levels, which tells us on average how the blood glucose has been controlled over the last 3 months. And certain organizations will suggest that you want to achieve a level of less than 7 or perhaps less than 6.5, less stringent in children. But the bottom line is that you want to be as close to normal as is possible without too much complicating hypoglycemia. So we know that glucose control is important. However, are there other things that perhaps contribute risk? For example, there is an emerging notion that needs to be tested more, that the amount that the blood glucose bounces around, the glucose variability or volatility, might be another risk factor for the development of complications. And that's something that's being explored. In addition, we know that there are other things that contribute to the risk of diabetes complications. One's blood cholesterol level and also one's blood pressure are equally as important.
To bring it back to the artificial pancreas, this is what makes it so important because, as the gentleman says, there are risks to tight control of blood glucose. And the risk is hypoglycemia, that you give yourself too much insulin in an attempt to bring glucose down. And that's what makes these automation attempts, the devices that will essentially respond to that and regulate glucose by cutting off insulin when a person is going low, so important.
Any sense yet, Jeffrey, of what this device would cost?
We believe it's going to cost more than a continuous glucose monitor, which exists today and is on the market, and a pump put, you know, added up together because there's an additional control element. Mm-hmm. But we don't have the costs specced out for that. And it also is going to be heavily influenced by what insurance companies are willing to pay. So at the end of the day, in our system, insurance companies have to pay for this in order for it to be a viable business for companies. And, you know, so there's a very intense negotiation that goes on between those companies and the insurance companies as to what it is these devices can cost to be widely available to people.
Seems like good control would be less expensive than having people in and out of the hospital for severe episodes.
That's absolutely the way to think about it, which is that this control, which is essentially preventative medicine, will save people hospital visits for low blood sugar and the debilitating complications which ensue from living with the disease and having high blood sugar. However, you know, historically, these complications take so long, many of them, the long-term complications, the macro and microvascular complications that we talked about earlier, they take so long to develop that, you know, insurance companies think, well, that person might be on another plan by the time, you know, I have to pay for them. So as we get to a different level of coverage in our system where everybody's going to be covered by someone, we might be able to take a more global view of these things and a longer-term view in terms of really seeing the benefit of having better control today in terms of reducing the costs in the future to our healthcare system.
1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org. Let's speak next with Bobby in Fort Worth. Hi, Bobby.
Good afternoon. How are you?
Great, thanks.
Good. My question is, my baby, she's 8 months old, and she was diagnosed with hyperinsulinism, and she actually had her pancreas removed, 98% removed. With that artificial pancreas, will that be available to infants and babies in general?
So the way this works is these things are always tested in adults first because it's easier and safer to test in adults. So, but eventually, as we prove effectiveness in adults, it will be extended to children, probably older children at first, and then, you know, to the youngest children. But yes, this technology is intended to serve anybody who can't make insulin on their own and therefore needs to have that delivered in order to control blood glucose.
I would also like to point out that I'm so excited about the artificial pancreas program because it eventually could help people with type 2 diabetes as well. Type 2 diabetes, which is associated with obesity and insulin resistance, has a progressive decline in beta cell function. Beta cells are those cells of the body that make insulin. And so in its very latest stages, people with type 2 diabetes clinically are very much like people with type 1 diabetes in the sense that they don't make any insulin. And so their diabetes is very difficult to control. And so something like an artificial pancreas could benefit them as well.
Why does an excess of fat and not enough activity lead to type 2 diabetes? What changes in the body over time when these conditions exist?
It's not entirely clear, but the deposition of fats in muscle, we believe, leads to reduced signaling that occurs as a result of the insulin molecule binding that muscle cell. And so basically there's less glucose uptake and processing within the cell that utilizes the glucose or the sugar.
Let's go back to the phones now. 1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Aaron in Dallas is on the line. Hi, Aaron.
Hi.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
I wanted to know about the correlation between a mother's gestational diabetes and the infant's proclivity to contracting diabetes because of its mother's condition.
Thanks for your call.
Yeah, that's a very interesting question, and it's one that's being actively researched. We know that the in utero environment certainly impacts one's future development of type 2 diabetes. So we believe that there is perhaps an increased risk of type 2 diabetes developing in the offspring. But the issue is somewhat complicated in the sense that both mother and offspring have both a similar genetic background as well as a similar environment. So this is something that we're very much interested in, and people are researching actively, but ultimately we don't know yet exactly what the risk of increased blood glucose levels is during pregnancy on the future development of diabetes in the offspring.
There is a risk, though, to women who have gestational diabetes. There's a correlation to developing full-blown diabetes themselves a couple of decades after the pregnancy?
Absolutely, yes. And again, this is type 2 diabetes. And what we know from studies primarily in a Hispanic population is that if a woman has gestational diabetes, the chance that she will continue to have diabetes after her pregnancy and therefore type 2 diabetes is about 10%. And they develop type 2 diabetes at a rate of about 10% every additional year for an additional 5 years. That was the length of one large study that was done in Los Angeles. And so, yes, if a woman has gestational diabetes, we believe that her risk of developing type 2 diabetes approaches 50% after 5 years.
Jeffrey, why for type 1 diabetics are the teenage years so scary for doctors and parents and for the patients themselves? But they sort of fall off the wagon in terms of taking good care of themselves.
Well, adolescence is a challenging time for in general, and type 1 diabetes is a challenging disease to live with, and it's not really a fair imposition to put on a child to have to be that responsible for something that the body should be doing by itself. When young children are diagnosed, it's really the parents who do it for them, who monitor what they eat, who test their blood sugar, who make the decisions about how much insulin to give. But as a child grows up and becomes more independent, as you want them to, as they begin to rebel, which I guess is a teenager's job, they have to do more of it themselves. And that's a challenge. It's a challenge for them and for the parents. And so this introduces an additional burden in terms of adolescence that, unfortunately, it's not really fair to impose on them.
My guests this hour are Jeffrey Brewer, President and CEO of the Juvenile Diabetes Research Foundation, and Dr. Gregory Clark, an endocrinologist specializing in diabetes at UT Southwestern Medical Center. You can join our conversation now by calling 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's summer youth programs. Camps in computers, writing, art, math, science, and Legos held at SMU in Plano and on the main campus in Dallas. You can learn more at smu.edu/summeryouth.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guests this hour are Dr. Gregory Clark. He's an endocrinologist specializing in diabetes. He's also a researcher and assistant professor at UT Southwestern Medical Center. Jeffrey Brewer is with us as well. He's president and CEO of the Juvenile Diabetes Research Foundation, which holds its annual Dream Gala fundraiser this Saturday, March 26th at the Hilton Anatole in Dallas. You can find information about that on the Think page of KERA.org. If you want to join our conversation, the number is 1-800-933-5372. Let's go next to Sandy in Arlington. Hi, Sandy.
Hi. I have a couple of questions. I heard him say that the artificial pancreas wasn't available and they didn't know how much it was. The current pump, does he know how much that is and how does it differ from the artificial pancreas? That's one question. What is normal A1C? That's another question. And my last one is Department of Transportation, DOT physicals, now require that a person that takes insulin cannot pass a physical. However, if their diabetes is managed by pills or diet, they can pass it. If the person is using a pump, that's not even addressed in this DOT physical. What happens there? Would there be a waiver for that? Because that seems like the ideal thing. If they were using a pump, they would never have any control problems.
Well, thanks for your call, Cindy. I'm not sure if our guests want to weigh in on the Department of Transportation physicals, but let's...
Well, on the cost of an insulin pump, insulin pump costs a few thousand dollars, and then you have an additional cost of the tubing and the infusion set, which is where the insulin actually goes into the body that needs to be changed out on every 2 to 3 day basis. So there's sort of a cost ongoing over time to use these devices. The difference between an insulin pump today and an artificial pancreas is that an insulin pump doesn't make any decisions about how much to dose. It only doses based on what has been programmed into the pump by the person. So you have a certain trickle flow of insulin that goes on all day long in order to cover the body's daily metabolic process. But the real action happens around meal times when a person has to count carbs for a meal and enter that into the insulin pump. The insulin pump does make a calculation based on the number of carbohydrate grams that are consumed, delivers a bolus of insulin. That is a process, however, that needs to be driven by the person making the decisions. What we're talking about in an artificial pancreas is something that will take the glucose level from a continuous glucose monitor, make decisions about how much insulin to give, and then do that automatically.
Sandy also had a question about A1C levels. Can you explain that term to us, first of all?
Yeah, so the hemoglobin A1C tells us, as physicians and healthcare providers, how someone has done in terms of their blood glucose control over the last 3 months. We do this by drawing blood and looking at the red blood cells. And red blood cells live for about 3 months. And we look at a particular protein within those red blood cells. And by looking at the amount of glucose that is attached to that protein, it gives us an idea as to how well the blood glucose control has been on average over the lifespan of the red blood cell, or 3 months. And so normally, if someone doesn't have diabetes, their hemoglobin A1C level would be 5 or less than 5. In diabetes, I tend not to focus so much on a number. We know that the lower your A1C, the less is your risk of developing complications. And so we certainly would be happy with something that's less than 7, or, you know, some organizations advocate a value of less than 6.5. This is in adults. It's a little less stringent in children and adolescents. But the bottom line is that the more that you try to maintain a blood glucose concentration close to normal, the greater is your risk of developing debilitating low blood sugar. And so what I like to focus on more than anything is, let's get the A1C as low as we can without too many complicating low blood glucose reactions.
We have an email here from a listener who says, I have type 2 diabetes. I was diagnosed soon after completing a 150-mile bike race. I am female, 6 feet tall, and weigh 130 pounds. People who don't know me well assume I used to be obese, but I've always been lean and athletic. I do not have any risk factors. I'm tired of being stigmatized, and so are my other skinny type 2 friends. And she says, stop calling it a lifestyle disease. Are there people who really don't fit the profile that are sort of being lumped in with those that are assumed to have caused their own misery?
There are certainly people who develop type 2 diabetes who are not obese. And the way we're thinking about obesity and the development of type 2 diabetes has really come a long way. We think that fat cells, adipocytes, are important for storing excess energy in the form of fat. But at some point, they reach a maximum capacity. And when that occurs due to overeating or a lack of exercise, then fats begin to spill out over into other tissues of the body, where they begin to wreak metabolic havoc. And so there are certain people who, for reasons that we don't totally understand, don't have an ability to expand their fat mass. And so those are people who are perhaps more susceptible to the development of type 2 diabetes, even though they're thin. And it's tough for them because they don't, you know, have much reserve capacity in terms of storing excess calories in the form of fat before they develop type 2 diabetes. But for all people living with diabetes, exercise and maintaining a moderate diet will nonetheless be beneficial. And so I would advocate.
I would also want to point out that we're learning that a number of adults with that are diagnosed with type 2 diabetes with a similar body type to what this woman just described actually have type 1 diabetes. They have an autoimmune form of type diabetes, which is slower progressing. Mm-hmm. And in many cases, these folks come to the doctor and they have the symptoms of high blood sugar, and they're put on type 2 diabetes medications, which when you do have some ability to produce insulin still will work for a while. And since it is a slower progressing form of type 1 diabetes, these folks don't actually realize their type 1 diabetes, maybe ever. And the doctors treat them as type 2s. They end up going on insulin. But we're finding that there's a lot of evidence that many people were being misdiagnosed. So if I had that kind of body type and I was being treated as a type 2 diabetic, I'd confirm whether or not I was type 1 by getting the testing for the antibodies. It's possible to confirm whether it's the autoimmune kind or whether it is type 2 diabetes.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Gus in Dallas. Hi, Gus.
Hey, thanks, Chris. A while back, I read of a sort of tattoo that shows blood sugar levels by shining some special light on it instead of getting blood samples. I was wondering if the doctors have heard of that or if there's any news.
There are a number of innovative ways that are being researched to try and determine the body's glucose level non-invasively. That is one that is currently being researched. I think those are still in pretty early stages of development.
Let's talk about the finger stick, because people who haven't had to do this to themselves multiple times a day might think, well, this is a relatively minor deal. This is a big intrusion into people's lifestyles. Can either of you speak to that?
Well, yes. The finger stick, it's a pretty unpleasant process, although it becomes very routine to people living with type 1 diabetes. As Greg said, doing it anywhere between 3 and 10, 15 times a day in some cases for people who have very difficult to control blood sugar levels. You basically have to use a small needle to prick a finger and draw blood. That blood needs to be analyzed by a little testing device that people carry around with them to determine what the blood sugar concentration is at any given point in time. That needs to be done every time you eat. Every time you exercise, when you're stressed, if you're sick, because these are all things that can affect blood sugar levels. So it is quite an onerous process. It is unfortunately something that you mentioned adolescence earlier. Last thing an adolescent wants to do is declare him or herself as different mm-hmm. than everybody else. Meal times are very social. That's why you find kids don't comply as well, because the last thing they want to do is say, oh, wait a second, before I eat that, let me go through this process that basically everybody's going to ask questions about and wonder, why am I different? So it's tough. That's why continuous glucose monitors, which can do this in a continuous way and perhaps a little less conspicuously, and then eventually make these decisions for the person with an artificial pancreas, can be so beneficial to lifestyle.
Yeah, finger sticks hurt. Mm-hmm. And, they're done on the fingertips, and we use our fingertips a lot. And so you have all these wounds, and they get irritated. In fact, patients report that the finger sticks hurt more than the insulin injections. So it's a real problem.
Could the artificial pancreas also have sort of a remote capability to beam back to mom and dad or to an adult son or daughter dealing with, a parent with this disease? Could we sort of monitor from afar?
I think absolutely that's an opportunity. In an age where my 10-year-old daughter says she absolutely has to have a cell phone because all the kids in her class do. Well, that's not quite true, but half of them do. So kids have these devices already. So one of the things we're looking at, and we're funding research to actually tie insulin pumps and CGMs into cell phones to basically create that communications link so that parents can have some additional information about how their kids are doing during the day.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Linda is on the line in Fort Worth. Hi, Linda.
Hi. I have a question probably for Dr. Clark. I read an article recently, I believe it was out of UT Southwestern, about a possible cure for diabetes. It involved blocking the production of certain hormones. I think glucagon was mentioned specifically, and by doing that would cure diabetes. Is that true, or is there anything going on about that?
That goes back to the study we were talking about earlier, but cure may be a premature word.
Cure is certainly not the word to use. Yes, so this is another manifestation of the creative genius of Roger Unger. This was really him and his lab. And in this line of investigation, what he did was he took a mouse that has been genetically modified so that the mouse does not respond to glucagon. So we know that insulin helps us to metabolize fuels. It helps us to move glucose from our bloodstream into our tissues. Essentially, it lowers blood glucose concentrations. Glucagon is a hormone that works exactly opposite of insulin. It works to increase blood glucose levels. And what Roger Unger has shown is that in an adult mouse, if you destroy the insulin-producing beta cells, and the animal has no ability to also respond to glucagon, diabetes does not develop. Ultimately, what this means is that glucagon is a very important player in the manifestation of diabetes. But to think that we could ever create a human equivalent of that it seems very unlikely. But it does have us interested in the idea of developing or finding drugs that will suppress glucagon.
Yeah. It's important to note that, you know, this is part of the research process, testing therapies, testing drugs in mice, and then moving on to people. We have 43 different cures in mice for type 1 diabetes, none of which have successfully translated to people. That's not to say this is any less promising, because I actually think it could be a very important part of the overall picture in terms of controlling glucose, because the body of a type 1 diabetic is actually deficient in a number of hormones, not just insulin. We focus on insulin because insulin is required for life. If you don't have it, you actually die. However, there are other things that don't work properly in the metabolism of a type 1 diabetic. For instance, there's a hormone called amylin, which is made that by the body, not made by type 1 diabetics, that helps control the digestive process and how quickly carbohydrates get turned into glucose in the bloodstream. That doesn't work properly in type 1 diabetics, so there's an opportunity to take that drug and actually supplement for better glucose control. Leptin is another great opportunity that might help us control blood sugar levels and actually control those dangerous spikes, either on the high end or the low end, which are so difficult in terms of managing blood glucose on a daily basis. So ultimately, we think the artificial pancreas might have multiple hormones being delivered, insulin, maybe leptin, amylin, or glucagon, and more like the body does work. That's the vision for the long term.
Where's the money coming for this research into the artificial pancreas right now, Jeffrey?
It comes from the people who support JDRF. We raise about $200 million a year and plow as much of that into scientific research to cure type 1 diabetes and to develop transformative treatments for living with this disease.
And talk a little bit about the event on Saturday night.
It's our gala here in Dallas, a very impressive event lined up. We do these galas at our chapters around the country, of which we have 84. This happens to be my hometown chapter because I grew up in Dallas.
Welcome home.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here and going to the gala this weekend with my parents, and have brought my family and my 16-year-old son who has type 1 diabetes.
Jeffrey Brewer is president and CEO of the Juvenile Diabetes Research Foundation. Its annual fundraising gala is this Saturday. You can find information on the Think page of KERA.org. Dr. Gregory Clark is an endocrinologist with UT Southwestern Medical Center. Also, he is an assistant professor there. Gentlemen, thank you both so much for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.